The spread of the COVID-19 virus and its variants has become critical. For everyone's well-being, contact must be kept to a minimum, and health measures must continue, including washing your hands, keeping your distance, and wearing a mask. If you have symptoms, get tested and self-isolate at home. This effort is essential. For more information, visit quebec.ca/coronavirus. Let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
يا فرحتي تحاصرني مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليه. تحاصرني مرايا الروح وأنا أرحل مني إليه، ومن فضائي إلى أفق الأقحوان. أترقرق توهجا فوق عوسج الجدران، تسربلني النوارس وتعبر بي مني إليه. أينفي لدى الحنين في الخبايا، خذني إليه، فأنا الرمق الأخير يشتعل في صمت الحنايا، ويمتد مني إليه إلي، ويمتد مني إليه إلي. Thank you.
Welcome to our year-end episode of This is Palestine. I am Omar Bedar, and I'm here again with Diana Boutu. And today we're taking a broad look at what this year has meant for Palestine and what we can expect from 2022. Diana, in looking back at this year, I guess we can start at its beginning with what many consider to be one of the biggest shifts, the departure of Donald Trump and having a new administration in the U.S. under President Biden. What has that meant for Palestine?
Well, it's been what was expected, which was a big yawn. We haven't seen that there's been any real significant change on the ground. In fact, to the contrary, we've seen that that this administration has cemented many of the Trump policies, including the moving of the embassy illegally from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the fact that they haven't reopened the consulate, the fact that they've turned a blind eye to some of the most egregious forms of settlement construction expansion, the fact that we've seen so many Palestinian homes being destroyed by Israel. And all throughout, we've seen that the administration has largely remained silent on these major issues. So there really effectively hasn't been a change in policy. People are definitely happier that Trump is out because of the damage that he brought in his 4 years of office, and the fact that he went down a path of that is practically irreversible for any U.S. administration like the Biden administration. So people are definitely happy that he's gone, but on the ground, things substantially have not changed.
Right. Although I'd say that there were some changes that may be worth acknowledging in that they made a real difference in the lives of some vulnerable people, like the restoration of funding to UNRWA, the UN agency helping Palestinian refugees survive, and maybe some minor attempts at constraining some illegal Israeli settlement expansion. But I think you're absolutely right, Diana, in that U.S. policy, by and large, continues to be one of enabling Israeli apartheid and all the crimes that entails. And it was even a little surprising seeing how quickly the Biden administration caved on reopening the Jerusalem consulate serving Palestinians as soon as Israel objected to it. So you can see a difference where Israeli leaders seem to be able to dictate U.S.-Palestinian relations. And it's as if Biden is content being only slightly less awful than Trump without really offering a fundamentally different policy. But where things look pessimistic on the policy front, I think there are promising signs with the extent to which the human rights community is now finally on one page in acknowledging and explicitly naming Israeli apartheid.
Definitely. We saw this year, obviously, the Human Rights Watch report that came out and the B'Tselem report that also came out, two organizations that had in the past been shying away from saying what Palestinians have been saying for decades, which is that this is apartheid. And so it was very interesting here to see Human Rights Watch come out so strongly, and to see B'Tselem also come out so strongly to start using the language of apartheid. The disheartening part of it, of course, Omar, as I mentioned, this has been something that Palestinians have been saying for years, if not decades. And so it's sad that it took these two organizations to come forward to make the same assertions for people to start paying attention. But that said, I am glad that finally people are beginning to recognize this place for what it is, which is apartheid. And what was interesting, Omar, is that this isn't just a question of them looking at apartheid in the occupied territories, in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, but both of these organizations looking and defining it as apartheid across the board. So all of the territory that Israel is controlling from the river to the sea, and making those connections between what's happening in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and what's happening to Palestinians inside 48. And that part is very important.
It is very significant. And I think, as you mentioned, the fact that they're talking also about 48 and not just about the occupied territories really clarifies the extent to which apartheid is part of the foundation of Israel, that it's an entire country that is built on suppressing Palestinians and not seeing them as equal human beings. And that's essentially the entire political model that reigns from the river to the sea. And beyond the human rights organizations, I think that on the U.S. front, things have been promising in terms of American elected officials also starting to talk about Israeli apartheid. We have many members in Congress who actually used the word apartheid recently. I think Congresswoman Betty McCollum was the first to use it. And then during Israel's assault on Sheikh Jarrah and Gaza over the summer, Congresswomen Rashida Tlaib and Cori Bush and AOC all tweeted, "Apartheid states are not democracies," in a reference to Israel. And by the way, that reminds me of just how significant the events in May were for Palestine. And of course, you were in Palestine during all of it, so you got a front row seat to all of it.
May was one of the most difficult periods for Palestinians around the world, and especially for those of us who are living here. It was so traumatic to see Israel's full force, or what felt like Israel's full force, coming down, raining down on Palestinians. For example, we saw in May the flattening, the wholesale flattening of Israel, flattening buildings in the Gaza Strip, including, this was very near and dear to me, one of the buildings that I lived in when I lived in the Gaza Strip. We saw them flatten the AP building, and a building that housed the AP and other journalists as well, without so much as a major pushback. We heard some pushback by the United States and by the international community, but here we are almost 7 months later, and really nothing has happened. During that same month was when we saw the Israelis using weaponry on Palestinians during the holiest month of the Islamic calendar, during Ramadan, and in particular on the holiest day, which was Laylatul Qadr. We saw them using tear gas and stun grenades to try to prevent worshipers from praying at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and to try to, as they put it, disperse gatherings. In other words, disperse prayer. We also saw that during that same period that Israelis were going into Palestinian homes inside 48 as well, that even in Haifa, where I currently reside, we saw mobs parading through the street with the support of the Israeli police, going in, grabbing people from their homes, smashing cars. And in one very horrific event in Lod, we saw Israelis pull a Palestinian driver out of his car and beat him to within inches of his life. This is what May felt like. There wasn't a single Palestinian who felt safe. There wasn't a single person who felt as though they could lead a normal life. And you could really feel that, at least for me, it felt as though this was once again the same scenes that you can imagine were happening in 1948. You know, we are often told as Palestinians that we're supposed to somehow forget the Nakba. And yet here we were seeing these images over and over again, with not by the generation that perpetrated the Nakba, but by one or two generations later. And so you really got a sense of what it's like to live under Israel's thumb, to live under Israel's wrath, and to feel the level of insecurity, of fear, of everything that our parents and grandparents lived through, coming through right at our doorsteps.
Certainly the scenes were absolutely horrifying, and you could really, it was clear as day to see the extent to which anti-Palestinian racism animated the events that unfolded, not just in terms of the actions of the Israeli government, but more broadly in Israeli society, the extent to which it was permissible to see the scenes that we saw of Palestinian shops being broken into, people being pulled out of their cars, the beatings that unfolded throughout the entire country. I mean, it really was a horrifying scene. But I think that there's also an upside in all of this, is that the extent to which what was happening, the injustice, the sheer injustice and hatred that was motivating these events was so transparent for the entire world to see, that we saw the backlash to that as well. We saw the extent of growing Palestinian solidarity across the world, really. And we also saw Palestinians themselves come together. You know, those arbitrary and artificial divisions that Israel imposed on them seem to have vanished during the summer in terms of Palestinians coming together to protest also from the river to the sea.
Yes. One thing that became very apparent is that, especially for those of us who live in 48, we have had to hear time and again about hear the word coexistence. And it became very clear that there is no coexistence inside 48. We as Palestinians subexist. And that became quite apparent in the way that Israel was perpetrating attacks. Israelis were allowed to perpetrate attacks. And the rhetoric that came out of so many members of Knesset, so many Israeli leaders, in which it became clear that this isn't a question of people living equally side by side, but that they unleashed this level of hatred that they had been brewing for years and years and years. So the only thing that came out of this was that no longer am I hearing words like, is there coexistence in Haifa? Is there coexistence in Yaffa? Instead, I think there's a growing realization that there isn't any level of coexistence. We just end up sharing space, but we're definitely not coexisting. We're living in a framework of apartheid and colonialism.
And I certainly will have to plug in here the absolutely powerful piece that you wrote in the New York Times titled "The Myth of Coexistence." If folks have not had a chance to read it, please go and look it up. It's, really a sign of the shifting discourse, the fact that it was published and prominently featured in the New York Times, and it was an absolutely great piece.
Thank you.
There's the issue, of the fact that many liberal politicians in America have made Netanyahu individually, personally responsible for things being bad and racist and all of that. And now we have the departure of Netanyahu, and we have Naftali Bennett taking over as Israeli prime minister. And it feels like there isn't a recognition of the extent to which, in some ways, he's even a worse face than Netanyahu when it comes to many issues in terms of many of the pronouncements he's made in the past, but also the extent to which the problem of anti-Palestinian racism and anti-peace attitudes and anti-coexistence are much more systemic in Israel beyond just Netanyahu.
Oh, for sure. Netanyahu became the single focus of many diplomats, with the idea being that all that needs to happen is he needs to be replaced. And he did need to be replaced. He was a person who had really put into place some of the worst policies when it came to Palestinians. He was the driving force behind much of the racist legislation against Palestinians. He was the person who pushed for the criminalization of the BDS movement. He's the person who has pushed for annexation. He's pushed forward more settlements than any other Israeli prime minister. And he's carried out more attacks on Gaza than any other prime minister. But that being said, I think that the focus was anybody but him. And here we are now with Naftali Bennett in this coalition. This comes after, of course, four elections held within 2 years. This coalition that's been cobbled together that includes one Arab party, which is the Islamic Movement of the North, as well as his right-wing, very right-wing party. It's actually called Yamina, meaning right. And all of these people coming together with what feels to be like the single focus of making sure that Netanyahu doesn't come back into power. But again, for those of us living here, for those of us on the ground, nothing has changed. We still see that the very racist legislation that Netanyahu put into place, including a law that allows Israel to destroy Palestinian houses, we still see that that's in full force and effect. We still see that plans for annexation, creeping annexation, are continuing. We still see that there have been large settlement announcements of large settlement projects. And even during the past couple of weeks, where we've seen some of the worst storms here in Palestine, that Israel has continued the process of destroying Palestinian homes leaving people homeless in the middle of storms and in the middle of COVID. So there hasn't been any real substantive change on the ground, but yet it seems to me that the outside world seems to be focused less on Palestine. What do you think, Omar?
I think that's really spot on. And specifically, you know, everything that you're describing in terms of the status quo in Israeli policy continuing regardless of who's prime minister, it has been incredibly disappointing watching the reaction from the U.S. administration being what it's always been, literally for now decades, of this minor, subtle words of objections, you know, as tepid as can be, about how we don't think settlements are helpful and this and that, but without any effort of meaningful accountability at all, in a situation in which the U.S. holds tremendous power and influence and leverage over Israel. Talking about U.S. military funding to the tune of nearly $4 billion every single year, that's never on the table. And President Biden has made it clear that that will never be on the table, which is, you know, you're announcing that you're abdicating any leverage you have over a state that is behaving like an outlaw state and is committing crimes left and right. And it just, it defeats the entire claim of the U.S. trying to play any kind of positive role here. When you insist that you are going to fund the crimes of another country no matter what, then they have simply no incentive to stop or to change course. But I think what has been powerful to me is watching the extent to which civil society is stepping up where governments have failed, watching the growth of the BDS movement. And perhaps one of the most significant actions, in my opinion, is the huge and popular and socially conscious ice cream company Ben & Jerry's announcing that they will no longer sell ice cream in illegal Israeli settlements. But I don't know if you think that has been significant as well.
It's absolutely delicious, I have to say.
For sure.
So many ways. I know that their announcement is limited in scope, that they're just talking about the settlements. And I know that there's been a lot of criticism of it just being about the settlements. But I want to put a slightly different perspective on this. The first is that they've taken this move, which other companies have not. But secondly, I personally think it's going to be very hard for them to be able to find a distributor who is going to abide by those conditions. So effectively, I think that we're probably seeing the end of Ben & Jerry's in all of historic Palestine, meaning that yes, they are talking about it being a campaign that's only focused on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, but I think in practice, it's probably going to be a little bit bigger than that. And that's a good thing. I think that it's important for these companies to step up and to stand by things that they claim to be upholding, the beliefs that they claim to be upholding. I wish that there were more companies that were following suit. I know that Ben & Jerry's has come under a great deal of pressure and a lot of fire, not just here, but, and you could speak to it more in the United States. But I do think that this is significant. And I can tell you that over here, the Israelis have been freaking out because they've spent all of these years not only not being held accountable, they've been rewarded for their bad behavior. Look, we just finished talking about what they did in May, where they literally flattened buildings, including flattening the building that housed the Associated Press. And in return, they ended up getting not just the regular tune of funding, but they got more funding for the Iron Dome. So seeing that a company is stepping forward and saying that they're going to take a position is actually, for me, I'm very pleased by it. And I really hope that more companies end up following suit.
Absolutely agreed. And it's kind of interesting also seeing the extent of the repression targeting Ben & Jerry's parent company right now, Unilever, here in the U.S., where multiple American states are divesting from the company because they are disassociating from Israeli settlements. I mean, it's quite a moment here in the U.S. in terms of the repression and the you know, boycotts are a fundamental part of American political culture. It's protected by the First Amendment. The Supreme Court has weighed in on it. It's part of what it means to operate in a society that has any freedom, free expression, that you can make those kinds of decisions for yourself. And yet we are seeing the government in many states punish an American company for divesting from a foreign country's war crimes, which is really insane. And I think that that's going to be a huge battle that has to be fought here in the U.S. in terms of pushing back against these efforts to really coerce people into being supportive of Israeli war crimes, which simply does not make any sense. But I know that this campaign is also not happening in isolation, that it's also matched by a campaign of repression that is happening by the Israeli government against Palestinians directly, and more specifically against Palestinian human rights advocates and organizations. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, definitely. In October, last week's of October, Benny Gantz, who's the Israeli Minister of Defense, made two announcements. The first was that he was classifying these six NGOs, including Damir, which works with Palestinian prisoners, and Haq, which has been instrumental when it comes to doing the evidence gathering for the claim before the International Criminal Court, and DCI Palestine, which tries to protect Palestinian kids from arbitrary arrest by the Israelis. These, along with three other organizations, were labeled to be supporting terrorism, and as a result, under Israeli law. And then a few days later, they also announced that they made a similar announcement using the laws that are in effect, the military rules that are in effect in the West Bank. What they've done by making these pronouncements is they've effectively made it near impossible for these organizations to be able to operate. Under Israeli law, these organizations, people who work for them or support them, can face imprisonment. They can face up to 25 years in prison for working for these organizations. And people who express words of praise, words of support, etc., can also face up to 3 years in prison for simply expressing support or praise for the work of these organizations. They've also made it virtually impossible for these organizations to be able to get funds from international donors. And they've also made it such that the assets of these organizations can be seized at any moment. Now, to be clear, Omar, this is not new for Al-Haq or for Damir. For example, Sha'wan Jabarian, who's the general director of Al-Haq, spent 8 years in administrative detention. That means being held in prison without charge, without trial. 8 years of his life were taken away, being thrown in an Israeli prison for these same reasons. Sha'wan was also barred from travel for 7 years of his life. So in addition to the eight that he was thrown in prison without charge, 7 years of his life, he was unable to travel. The offices of Al-Haq and of Damir have been routinely smashed into. The Israeli army has routinely raided them and stolen things from their offices. So this is not new. But the new part of it is that now we're seeing that the people who work for these organizations, who support them, can actually be thrown in prison. But more importantly, they're trying to crush the work that they're doing by making sure that they have no funding sources. And I just don't think that it's coincidental that that Al-Haq, which has been around for 40 years, that suddenly now they're being labeled as supporting terrorist organizations or supporting terrorism, when we just saw that they've been the organization that has been the most, that's been on the front lines of providing evidence to the International Criminal Court against Israelis, including Benny Gantz. I just don't think that that's coincidental in any way, shape, or form. What we're slowly seeing is that they're trying to crush these organizations just in the same way that they've tried to crush Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, they're accused of supporting terrorism when they are providing evidence to the international community about Israeli terrorism against Palestinians. I mean, that's really what exactly is happening. And Look, it's hard to find a silver lining in this kind of repression. But if we had to find one, I think that it would have to be that the mask is dropping and that Israel declaring openly war against human rights organizations, both Palestinian and international, in a way that many European countries have spoken out against. You know, they're saying that the evidence is really not there about what they're claiming. And now they're going on imprisoning human rights defenders and placing them in dungeons without charge or trial, is really making it ever more clear the extent to which that this face, this facade that Israel tries to preserve about how it's a democracy and cares about human rights is now just completely dismantled. And everybody can see exactly what Israel's doing. I don't think we can wrap up, Deanna, without talking about the interview that just came out with Donald Trump just this week.
Yes.
In which, I mean, honestly, right? Like it's really fascinating just getting his candid feelings about Netanyahu and Israel and the American Jewish community. What did you make of it?
Look, we always knew that Trump was an anti-Semite. We always knew that Trump was supporting Israel because he thought that it was going to be good for his election campaign. He just made it very clear now. And we also always knew that he was a narcissist. And again, he made it clear. You know, the part that was really interesting about this interview was that he somehow expected that because he had given Israel so much, and indeed he did give Israel so much. We started our conversation talking about this. He recognized the Golan Heights as being part of Israel when it's not. That's illegal. He moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, again, illegal. He was pushing for his Trump plan, which would have allowed for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, again, illegal. He shut down, he effectively cut all funding to UNRWA and to other organizations that were helping Palestinians. He closed down the consulate. I mean, these were all things that were on Netanyahu's wish list. And indeed, you know, Trump fulfilled them. Trump gave him everything that he wanted. But somehow in return, he expected that Netanyahu was going to be a person who was going to stand by him when it came to his allegations that somehow the U.S. election was rigged when we know it wasn't. And so that is the part that is a little bit shocking, is that it's clear that he was dealing in Palestinian rights or giving away Palestinian rights for his own personal benefit, because, and he was expecting that there was going to be a personal reward for him, not anything beyond that. This wasn't a question of what other people try to falsely claim, that this is for national security reasons or any of that sort. He cut through it and he said, I'm doing this for Israel because I expect Israel to support me. I expect the Israeli government, including Netanyahu, to support me. And I expect Israel's supporters to support me. It was all about him personally. So it's been interesting to watch the reaction here because people are now waking up and realizing that Trump is an anti-Semite, something that we had all known for quite some time.
And to me, also the best part on top of all of this is now that Trump has been scorned by Netanyahu, the extent to which he was willing to be open and honest about the fact that Netanyahu had absolutely no interest in reaching a peace agreement of any kind. And I think that, you know, again, should be obvious to anybody who's even remotely paying attention in the slightest to what's unfolding, but it's a rare admission coming from a U.S. president. So it's nice when these kinds of things come out.
Absolutely.
So looking forward to 2022, I'm curious if there's anything that you think we should be keeping an eye on, any expected developments, anything that's, you know, in unfolding right now that could have major implications moving forward.
Yeah, there's a few things. Look, we'll be at the point in with the United States where it's the midterm. And I suspect that we're going to continue to see the Biden administration in this same holding pattern of conflict management rather than conflict resolution. And I think that that's something to definitely keep our eyes on. But more importantly, what we're seeing here in Palestine is that there are definitely many more small protest movements that are growing and developing. And We see this in places like Beita, like Bil'ain, where the protests have resumed, and in other places as well, such as in Nablus and in Khalil. So I think that's something to keep our eyes on. I also think that we should really be paying attention to what's happening within the Palestinian Authority itself. One thing that we didn't really talk about was the protest movement that's happened against the Palestinian Authority with the assassination of activist Nizar Banat. We are seeing that there are many more protests now that are taking place against the Palestinian Authority itself. I also think that we need to be focused on what's happening with all of these settlement plans. I suspect, given the configuration of this Israeli government, you know, Israeli governments don't last very long because they're always coalitions. And I think that that Naftali Bennett is going to want to secure as much as possible so that he can get elected to be prime minister. And in order to do that, it means that he's going to be pushing much more for Israeli settlement expansion. We've seen it already. And I think that we're going to see many more of these like creeping annexation moves happening in the West Bank as well. That's what I suspect we'll be seeing. Another thing that we really must keep our eyes on is Gaza and what Israel is going to be doing in Gaza. And of course, whether we're going to see more criminalization of Palestinian NGOs.
Absolutely. It's certainly looking down in terms of what Israel plans on the ground. The racist repression is escalating. There's no question about it. But it's always met with relentless and ever more creative Palestinian resistance on the ground. And I know that in the U.S., as much as the Biden administration is turning out to be, I would want to say, a predictable disappointment, there is also progressive energy that is growing. And it really sets the stage for a potential shift that could come, at least what's happening in discourse and hopefully eventually in American policy. You know, we've always said that the status quo of permanent occupation and apartheid is untenable, and it feels like change is happening at an accelerated rate right now. And so we're certainly looking forward to see what 2022 has in store for us. Deanna, it's always great talking with you. And maybe do you want to give our listeners just a quick taste of what we have lined up in 2022?
Yes, definitely. We have some really exciting podcasts coming up in the new year, including some podcasts about what is done with Palestinian olives. We all know about the olive picking season, but our podcast is going to go into a deep dive about olives themselves. We're also working on a piece on Palestinian art, everything from the art of mosaics to icon making. And of course, we are going to continue our discussion with Palestinian political prisoners. And we hope that 2022 will bring much joy for all of you. Thank you for listening and staying with us.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. I'm Deanna Bucci. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
يروح بسرعة، ما كان بده يروح بسرعة، ما كان بده يروح.
So that's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Age 60 and over? Now's the time to make your appointment for your booster dose against COVID-19. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to book your appointment online. To continue protecting yourself against COVID-19 and its variants, get a booster dose and keep following distancing measures, wearing a mask, and washing your hands. The booster dose, the best way to stay protected longer. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Have you ever stopped to think about how your actions impact others? Have you ever stopped to consider how the talking always meant for you? Do you get the message when I ignore of your calls? Finally had enough, strung it out for way too long. You act so surprised when I call you out for being shady. On a different wave, I'm on a different wave. With your energy, you fill me up with negativity. On a different wave, I'm on a different wave, and I don't fuck with your energy. Why don't you wash away from me?
Pull up to the spot, turn heads till they drop. If I'm on the track, it's a bop. I know that I'm a star, bitch. I walk away and they all follow.
Time to make up your mind, to figure it out, to fuck it all up each time.